Imagine for a moment, we live in a world where everyone and every company knows about their transformative purpose. And together, we are creating a better world than how we found it.
Good day and welcome to the Transformative Purpose Podcast. Today, we build community to inspire. My special guest today is Ashley Dudarinog, who is passionate about digital marketing and know everything about marketing in China. She runs two very successful businesses in China, Alaris and Chosun, Chinese social media agency, and also a business training school. She's also the creator of The Fire, a personal development course designed with women in mind. Ashley is many things. She is Amazon best-selling author, global keynote speaker, trainer, media contributor, and female leadership advocate. And during our podcast today, we're going to have a chat with Ashley to understand her unique upbringing, entrepreneurship experience as a woman and foreigner in China, marketing trends, consumer behaviors, and some of the new internet policies coming out of China. Welcome, Ashley. How are you and where are you this morning?
Hey, Aaron. Awesome to be on the show. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well and I'm dialing in from Hong Kong.
Oh, great. We're in the same city.
Yay.
How are you this morning?
Doing absolutely fabulous. We've got a gorgeous weather. Going through this COVID lockdowns, I think there's a lot of places in the world that are much worse than Hong Kong. We are safe and sound. The weather is great. We have the beaches, we have water, and business is doing well as well.
I love your positive outlook. I think we're quite fortunate in Hong Kong. Even though everyone is still wearing a mask, I think we are relatively free compared to what's happening in other countries.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask you first question. I want to ask you something about yourself. You speak four languages. Very impressive. German, Mandarin, Russian, and English. I can only speak three. Your Mandarin is probably better than mine. You grew up in Russia. I heard in a small village. You live in New Zealand, study in China. You're now working in Hong Kong, focusing on mainland customers. Can you tell us a bit more about your upbringing?
Sure. Well, calling Vladivostok, which is a Haisheng Wei, a city close to mainland China, a village, is a bit of an overstatement. But yes, I was born in the Soviet Union back then in Vladivostok, which was a closed military port. We had back then 500,000 or 600,000 people, which is for Soviet or let's say Russian standards, it's still a big town, the biggest in the Russian Far East. And yes, I was born in the last years of the Soviet Union. Growing up in Vladivostok was really fun because we had a lot of multicultural kind of, you know, bridges and interaction, despite the fact that it was Soviet Union. So we were basically the cities bordering on mainland China, Korea and Japan. And we were exposed to all these cultures. Like the first place that I visited, that I've traveled abroad, was actually Japan and Korea. And the second place that I've ever visited outside of Russia was China. And yeah, it was fun. And then going forward, when Russia essentially started opening up and we had opportunities to travel abroad, study abroad, etc., I also went out to study in England and New Zealand and do my bit of exploring the world beyond just Russia. And then at 17 years old, I ended up in mainland China. I was in the city called Chongqing, which is central China, population-wise, the largest city in the world with 32 million people. And that was a huge change. There were so many things to learn, to see, to absorb. I went there to study. So I studied business and economics. And this is where my China journey has really begun, because there are many reasons, at least back then, right? It was more than 15 years ago. There were many reasons why foreigners would move to China, but hardly were they envisioning China, you know, becoming what it is right now so quickly. So everybody saw that this is a manufacturing hub, but it was not really about consumer market and innovation and, you know, this kind of future proof technologies. And for me, the same. I ended up in China not for the love of kung fu or noodles, not because I had this
xiaolongbao
for that matter, yes. And not because I saw this grand vision of China when I was 17, but it was basically love. I had a boyfriend of mine at the time. He was studying Chinese and I felt that this was awesome. We could go to China together. He could do his studies and his stuff and I could do my bachelor degree there. So I was like, okay, well, let's go to China. And the only person I knew, the only Chinese person that I knew very closely, was one of his university professors. And she was from Chongqing. We're like, yeah, great, let's go to Chongqing. So that's how sometimes by accident, so many journeys in our life, I believe, begin and they lead to something outstanding and amazing and very impactful. So my journey started in Chongqing. I spent 4 years there and I studied Chinese first and then, as said, business and economics.
Was it difficult studying a foreign language? How did you pick it up?
I honestly believe that Chinese is probably one of the simplest languages in the world. There's virtually no grammar whatsoever. You need to grasp a bit of the, you know, pronunciation because it's a tonal language, but it's also, you know, there's many other tonal languages in the world. So I don't think it's difficult. I think it's different and you need to know why. So for me, when I came to China, as said, I had to study the language first for the first 1 year because to do university degree in economics, you need to pass a Hanyu Shiping Kao Shi, which is like HSK. Basically, it's like IELTS English language course, right? And for me, I had very clear goal. So I studied every day for 4 or 5 hours in the university, kind of, you know, a course on, in Chinese language for international students. And then I spoke with people. And in half a year, I was able to pass HSK 6, which was enough to get to university. And I think when you have that clear goal in mind, you can do it. And you just need to forget all other Latin languages that you speak and start from scratch because it's a different language. And it's simple. It's very logical. And I personally love how it sounds as well. So it was fun.
Like I said, I think your Mandarin is probably better than mine.
Well, we can speak Mandarin to figure out.
No, I don't dare to go into that. Yeah, some people might drop out of this call. Was there any cultural shocks when you arrived into China?
Well, absolutely. Well, I would say that the biggest thing was it's really difficult for a young person like myself. Back then, I was 17 years old, to go into a completely different environment and just absorb and respect and, you know, be part of it instantly. Because when I think it's human nature, right, when we see something very different from us, we start judging. So for the first half year, to be honest, of my time in China, I was judging everything. And again, I would like to remind you that it was 15 years ago and it was not a sexy city like Shanghai or Beijing. It was Chongqing, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, I saw children urinating in the streets because or in supermarkets or
people
in
spitting on the ground.
Yes, yes, on the ground with, you know, these split pants. So I'm sure you know what they are. For those that don't know, these are the pants. And then there's basically a split kind of cut in the seat of your pants where you can just squat and basically do your business. And I was like, oh my goodness, how is this possible? So I was judging. Or for example, in the restaurant, people were speaking very loudly or, you know, spitting on the streets or whatever. Basically, for me, you call it cultural shock, but for me, it was me being the judger. And I think it is such a, you know, stupid approach. I mean, you come to a country with 5,000 years history, with people that were working so, so very hard to get to that, you know, new development stage so quickly. You come as an outsider to the place which is full of lessons, full of energy, full of gorgeousness. And all you do is you reject those gifts and you focus on what you want to judge from, you know, where you come from. Oh, that's not how you do things in business. So for me, yes, the first half year was difficult because I came with a different mindset. I was 17 years old. I was young and I was like judging what I could. And then something changed. Because I think when something is not working, work on yourself first. And I had that, I learned that lesson early on. And I was like, okay, it's clearly not very, you know, not very productive to be in the place where I come as a guest and I just don't accept those gifts, don't learn from these experiences. And I think this is also in business very obvious because China has so much to offer right now and also back then as a model, you know, to learn from, to experience. And China can learn from the rest of the world. And that's what China is doing. They're learning from the rest of the world. And very often the rest of the world, and I'm talking about primarily, you know, Western countries, they are not able to look beyond the things that they disagree with to learn from China. So that's where my half a year in mainland, that's where my kind of important turning point started because I focused on what I can learn and I accepted the things and the differences and I started enjoying them and I had a blast. And again, I just thank my mindset. I thank the, you know, upbringing that I had or the fact that I also was exposed to many cultures before the age of 17 when I moved to China, mainland. And yeah, I think that was very, very important for my future and for everything else that I do with China because I truly love this culture. I truly love seeing how it evolves. I can see it's not all perfect. Absolutely not. Nobody is. But I can see beyond it to really focus on what we can learn and how can we kind of build bridges and, you know, help everyone.
That's fascinating. Like you said, I think a coin has two sides, right? You can either embrace the change or you can reject the change.
Yeah.
And one of the criticisms for China, I guess, 10, 20 years ago was more so on sort of being criticized the sort of the East following the West. But I think with the recent successful example of TikTok, China is actually leading, is coming ahead.
Absolutely. And we're going to see more and more of that because innovation in China is built on, let's take the working model and let's make it better. And that's what a lot of, you know, Western companies out there judge as, oh, you know, they're copycatting and then they are just improving. And none of these companies have a competitive advantage if they bring it outside of mainland China. So that was the narrative for a very, very long time, saying that Chinese are not innovative and they cannot think outside of the box. They take a working model, make it slightly different, put a different logo on, launch it in the market. And the market is so protected. So no Facebook, no Google can work there. And then that's the only reason why these tech giants are successful. And there are some pointers that could help you make up that story. But in reality, this is not so. For Chinese people, I mean, in the West, at least when you talk about, let's say, Silicon Valley, from what I hear, from what I gather, in order to be an innovator, you need to invent a bicycle. You need to invent something completely different. And then everybody kind of looks at you and, you know, give you a bit of respect. But in China, if we look at the history, innovation was take something that's working and make it better and listen to the people and, you know, keep evolving. And that's what China has done with their, you know, technology companies, social media companies, e-commerce companies. And ByteDance is a great example of that because it's something very different. It's something very relatable to young people. And it's something that has truly done a great job going outside of China and, yeah, saying, hey, guys, we can also do that. And we can be successful outside of our home market. And they are showing amazing results. And there will be more and more companies like that. Of course, with the current, let's say, geopolitical climate, it's difficult for some companies to truly just go out and do business and expand and bring their technology because there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of, you know, fear. There's a lot of also, I would say, narrative, right? Fake media narrative that goes out.
This power struggle between the West and the East.
Absolutely. And of course, it's difficult for, you know, many companies, including ByteDance, to just go and export their technology and really explore international markets. But ultimately, one way or the other, maybe Chinese big tech giants, also from you know, our experience and the big companies that we work with, both Chinese and international, we see that many of them are just saying, okay, maybe the US and Europe are not really the markets where we need to go in first. Maybe it's Southeast Asia, the Russian-speaking world, Latin America and Africa, where we shall really be. Because ultimately, 70% of global consumers in about 30 years from now are going to live in those countries. So you don't really need the US. You don't really need Europe. You need all these other markets if you want to be a global player.
Yeah. I strongly believe for us to build a better world, everyone needs to work together and we need to leverage each other's strengths. So I came across Dragon Ashley. Can you tell me about who is this person?
Well, Dragon Ashley, I always say that, you know, when you start a business, it's a very lonely journey. I think when you start a business in Asia, where as a woman, where there are rather few role models, it's good to create your own kind of alter ego, to create your own role model, like a collection of different role models that you had from childhood, from movies, from real life, etc. So put your own alter ego together, call it Dragon Ashley or Sasha Fierce or whatever you want, and essentially make her an absolute kick-ass. So that was something that I actually was speaking about in my TED talk a couple of years ago when TED invited me to speak about my entrepreneurship journey here in Asia and how a person from, you know, a very different background from Soviet Union, right, where entrepreneurship was not really the name of the game, how somebody like me coming from that background, then moving to mainland China and then making it in business and going through all these troubles succeeded. And one of the biggest reasons for that was that I just collected all these lessons from China, from Chinese shoe sellers, as I always say, and women that were running the show and were absolute hustlers, and also from Soviet background, because in Soviet Union, because of the ideology and also practical necessity, the country empowered women. So I think that's what everybody needs to have. Get your role models together.
I should make a Dragon Aaron someday.
Aaron, Dragon Aaron sounds like you're from one of the triads. I would be very careful there.
So for the viewers on the podcast, if you don't have a role model, it's good to reimagine one and call it whatever you want. I had a look at your LinkedIn. You completed a few courses with Tony Robbins, renowned motivational speaker. What was that like and why did you do it?
Well, as I said a bit earlier, psychology is everything. And one thing that people need to understand when they start a business is that your business will never outperform the psychology of its founder. So if something is not working in your business, either sales are not happening or product delivery, or you just don't see a grand vision, something is not working out, work on yourself first. And your psychology, your mindset, the way you think is most of that success. And of course, the other part of that success is people that you surround yourself with, because people can either empower or dispower you. And if they empower you, you also can expand your mindset and essentially act with even more kind of not force, but also power, enjoyment, and energy. So yes, I actually had a mentor back in the day. It was maybe 6 years ago I had a mentor who was a business mentor, and he came in to set up some of the systems in my small company back then. And he was absolutely awesome. I love him so much, Moosh Pindrani. And he was a big fan of Tony Robbins. So I've never heard about Tony Robbins before. And he said, you know what, Ashley, like, there is one guy and I absolutely love him, da 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 da. So I was like, okay, well, let me watch a Netflix documentary about him. And there was this documentary called I'm Not Your Guru. I watched it and I hated it. I was like, okay, this is some weird guy. Like, clearly he is a guru. Clearly there's some sort of sect or cult. Lord knows what's going on. So I didn't really like it, and I never gave it another thought. So that was 5-6 years ago. And then I was working with another person who is a success psychologist. So back then our business won a really big account, so we had a really big company that we worked with, one of China's biggest companies, and everything had to change. So the way I manage the team, the way I look at processes. So this person, she's a certified, obviously, psychologist, and she works with people that suddenly reach a big level of success. For example, if you are on a talent show and suddenly you win America's Got Talent, and you've got all this media attention and you've got all this popularity coming, you know, very quickly, or you are an elite athlete and also you win gold medal and suddenly you need to, you know, sponsor, and Nike sponsors you, etc. So basically, she works with people like that. And we had a few sessions with her because of the fact that the business was becoming more successful, and I had to change my mindset and change the way I do things. And she said, okay, Ashley, I'm actually going to be flying to, you know, Singapore. Let's meet there and I'm going to bring you over to an event. I said, yeah, sure. So we met in Singapore and it was a Tony Robbins event. I was terrified because there were 12,000 people. I thought it was virtually a cult gathering. But then when Tony showed up, it was amazing. He is, I feel, a phenomenal human being. And essentially after that, within 9 months, I participated in all 6 or 7 of his programs. I flew around the world from Fiji to Las Vegas to Australia, you name it. I've basically been through all of his programs. And I think that when you learn from someone, you first of all, get a mentor. Something's not working in your business, get a mentor, get a success psychologist as well. And also, if you, for example, I was also in the speaking business, etc., learn from the best. And in that motivation, kind of, you know, also kind of happy clappy psychology, Tony Robbins is the best. He's giving you so much energy, so many tools that you can use later on. So I would say also pick somebody to learn from and just do it.
There's a lot of wisdom with what you just said. And I really like the fact that you mentioned when something is going well or when something is not going the way you like, always start within yourself. I think a common behavior that we observe for a lot of businesses is when performance is not great, they become reactive, they panic, and they start chasing goals, they start chasing businesses, they start harassing people.
Yeah.
What is the entrepreneurship environment like for women and foreigners in China versus Hong Kong, New Zealand, and Russia?
I think in China in general, there's tons of opportunities in mainland and in Hong Kong and in basically this part of the world. It's the whole of Asia is full of opportunities. But of course, right now, the consumer market in China mainland is the biggest, and working with this market is extremely rewarding. I personally never felt the need to, you know, specifically distinguish whether it's women entrepreneur or, you know, is it more difficult or less difficult. When I came into this industry and I'm in the market, industry. So I've got one agency and I also have one, as you mentioned, a training and consulting company that focuses on marketing and technology, etc. So when I came to this industry, you would have thought there's a lot of women because marketing, you know, HR are probably roles in a big organization that are usually held by women. But in our industry, all of the or most of the agency owners, especially back then, it was 10 years ago, were men. And I never really gave it a second thought before some of them would virtually say, for example, I had a business meeting with somebody and we were showing them one of the tools that we built. And then they said, and who is behind the business? I said, well, I'm the owner, I'm the founder. And he looks at his partner and says, wow, look at this, a chick built it. And I was like, okay, this is a bit weird.
Wow. They did not say that, right? That's the exact word.
Yeah, he said, he looks at his partner and says, yeah, hey, a chick built it. Yeah. And I'm in the room, like I'm on the video call. I was like, nah, this is a bit weird. So I come from a background where, as I said, Soviet Union empowered women. So I never gave it a thought. I thought I could be anything and there was no difference whether it's, you know, male entrepreneur or female entrepreneur. Mainland China also has phenomenal showcases of that. More women are running small and medium-sized businesses in China than men. And very often, you know, I mean, dragon moms and women very often in China are running the show and they're very good with money. They know how to name the price and get the price. I mean, they're very strong, full of motivation coming from there. My business was starting out from Hong Kong, even though we focused on the mainland China market. And in Hong Kong, I would say maybe there's a bit of the, you know, British legacy or I do not know what it is, but that's the only place where I started kind of hearing people talking about, oh, for example, I would publish a LinkedIn post and then somebody would say, oh, great legs under my LinkedIn post. And I was like, why is it relevant? Why are we publishing that on LinkedIn? This is not the point. So I started hearing people raise and talk about, oh, women in business are struggling more than men. But I choose not to really look at it this way. I believe that you as a person, as an individual in business and personal life, need to set boundaries. And people will only treat you the way you will allow them to treat yourself. And the issue very often is that we were not taught how to set healthy boundaries. So can there be, excuse me, a jerk who comes up on the street to another man and says something unpleasant? Yes, there can be such instance. And then it's up to you. How do you react? Whether you think it's kind of okay and you let it slip or not. And I think because of my background, maybe it was easier to understand what's not okay and then find ways to set those healthy boundaries. So I've actually never had very, you know, kind of difficult situations in business where I felt that I was really not treated right because I was a woman because I was from the, you know, Soviet Union or Eastern Europe or whatever, just because I believe I was able to set the tone and also set those boundaries very clearly. And I understand that for some women, it's a bit more difficult because of, again, the environment, the background that they had, and the fact that they just don't know how to do it. But I also know a lot of men that don't know how to set boundaries. So it's not about gender. It's really about being respectful to others, right? Focusing on the goal. What are we here to achieve on LinkedIn? Comment on the legs or actually get some insights about the market and learn how to say no, how to set boundaries and respect yourself first.
I would love to receive a personal comment if someone wanted to comment on my hair or my eyes or my body. I wouldn't mind that.
Guys, go to Aaron's LinkedIn and let him know how you feel about his hair.
Jokes aside, I spoke to a gentleman who specializes in LGBT a couple of weeks ago on this podcast. And personally, I'm really glad to see there are more women in leadership roles, and not just women in leadership, but there are a lot of other topics like LGBT, for example, agenda that are really coming to light. You know, people are paying attention to this important agenda. And for a lot of people, these issues are actually quite common in many families. We just don't talk about it. It's just more taboo in the Asian community.
That is true. That is true. Culture shapes a lot of things. Family shapes a lot of things. And that's the beauty of a person turning 18. After you are 18, you are your own woman or your own man. And that's where you can start working on some of those disempowering beliefs, limiting beliefs, the things that, you know, that are difficult for you to marry the external world's expectations as of being part of culture or a family and your own kind of inner state. And that's where you need to, you know, also work on yourself to gain the confidence to say things as they are, to make your own choices, and of course to also set healthy boundaries. And I believe with more and more people doing that, you can change the way family looks at it, you can change the way the culture looks at it. But most importantly, you should not be trying to change somebody else. Just, you know, be your own man or woman and have fun and stand for who you are and love yourself, because you cannot give what you don't have. So start with that self-respect and self-love, etc. And we are changing those cultures. Conversations are extremely important. Role models are extremely important. And then people taking action is also extremely important. I'm all up for it.
I'm sure with the work that you do and the achievements, a lot of people look to you as their role model. Now, we've been talking a lot about your upbringing, stories, about your personal life. I think we should turn our focus to business and also your specialty, your domain on digital marketing in China.
Absolutely.
Consumer behaviors in China. So I just want to pick your brain on this one. You've published several successful books. I follow your daily updates about what's happening in China. You post very interesting viral marketing videos about China and you know how different brands are communicating their purpose and their products and services to their audience. What are some of the trends that you're seeing with the Chinese consumer behaviors that other people should know? Have you seen any changes sort of pre and post pandemic?
It's a huge question. And I would like to start by giving a quick disclaimer. Whatever top 10 trends that people are announcing about China are by default, you know, not really representing the market, because mainland China, 1.4 billion people, the north and the south are completely different. The higher tier cities, lower tier cities are completely different. The attitudes, the desires, the trends, right? The things that satisfy those desires by age, by, as I said, location, by aspiration is completely different. So there are definitely some of the buzzwords that we're using to describe what's generally happening, how is the market moving. But mainland China is a complex market. And if you guys, any of you are planning to enter it, do your research before investing the money, because it's not as straightforward as to say, okay, right now everybody in, you know, Germany likes to be more green and save planet, etc. Because China is, again, much more complicated. But to say that, nonetheless, we have a lot of trends. And we also, of course, have observed in the past 1.5 years, huge shifts in consumer behavior and values as well. So the values have become more centered around health, you know, fitness and family and work-life balance. This is the general trend where it's going post-pandemic. And when it comes to digitalization, of course, we have looped in new consumer groups, for example, elderly generation. We have looped in people from much, much lower tier cities, like tier 4 and 5 cities, where this is their first experience with the internet and mobile apps and social media. So a lot of things are happening. And China, you know, has already eliminated poverty. So there was an official announcement actually already last year. And this year, there was an official announcement of eliminating poverty. Right now, the next kind of step in that journey is to eliminate digital illiteracy. So we have about 350 to 400 million people in China still that are not on, you know, internet and mobile devices. Of course, a big part of them are children, but another big part of them are elderly and people from very, very small kind of villages across the country. So the country is focusing on that. So this is to answer your question, what has changed during the pandemic? Many, many things changed. Now, in terms of trends, we have, of course, all the usual suspects, for example, like the pet economy, where people love pets. But this is, again, a part of a more global trend. And China is just manifested in a way that, for example, a colleague of mine that recently relocated to our Shenzhen office, she got herself not one, but two cats. So she's now the owner of two cats, and she's extremely happy with her boyfriend to be a part of this pet economy and spending money on spa for cats and whatnot. Then there is a big economy on financial and investment. So young people right now, even if they have one RMB, they choose to invest it. And when people meet for coffee, they actually talk about investments and how to better grow their wealth. So this is a big, big kind of trending thing. We have ACG economy, which is anime, comics and games. And young people truly enjoy that part of life, kind of merging online to offline and having their virtual characters meet up and, you know, and obviously play games, but also interact in the virtual setting. There's a lazy economy where people want things to be simple, easy. It can be, you know, from food delivery. It can be also the shoes that kind of lace themselves and, you know, kind of fix themselves, or it can be outfit that you don't need to ever wash, or using, you know, dry shampoo kind of things, but taken to extreme and making it very digital. So lazy economy among actually two consumer groups, the younger generation like Gen Zs, and also the older generation is growing very fast. As I mentioned, fitness economy is big because everybody is kind of looking at how to become fit and better. But in this respect, we need to also know that a lot of people in China claim that they go in for sports, but then they just take picture for Weibo and that's where it ends. About 200 million people, in fact, are falling into that category of kind of pretend fitness fans. There's night economy, guilt-free economy, medical beauty, there's sheer economy, there's fan economy that's very big. So as you see, there's a lot of things that are happening. Green economy, Guochao economy, home economy, blind boxes, ta-da-da. I would always prefer, you know, that people that go into China, as I mentioned before, really look into what are they trying to achieve, who is the consumer group that they're really trying to reach, and then translate that into what shall a brand or a company do.
Yep, or they come and speak to you first.
Or that.
I want to ask you about digital marketing versus offline marketing. Do you think offline marketing is still relevant? Should people still be thinking about having integrated marketing plan, you know, sort of with the O2O marketing approach, or should people be allocating more budget towards digital marketing now?
Well, digital marketing budget allocation is growing around the world and mobile leading in that, you know, increase and rise year by year. Nevertheless, integrated marketing is the name of the game, just like integrated commerce. Nobody cares whether you sell, you know, through e-commerce or you sell offline. For a consumer, they want to get a merged experience. Right, we call it OMO, online merging offline, and that goes in the retail space, it goes in the marketing space, it goes into communication or customer service space. So you just need to be able to bring virtual and physical together. So that is why right now in China we have a lot of pop-up stores. Brand, for example, if you are a luxury tableware brand and you only have a store in, let's say, Shanghai, you cannot be all across China, but you have customers all across China. And yes, you can have a very strong digital presence and your Tmall pages are up and beautiful and all that. But what a brand like this would typically do right now is to go out to places like Chongqing, Chengdu, Urumqi, etc., and they would actually open pop-up stores that would be open for 1 or 2 weeks to show people that, first of all, yes, I'm here, check out, you can feel and touch the product. And then if you want to buy after today, if you want to tell your friends, you can also go online and do that. So online and offline, yeah, basically, it's all part of one reality in today's world.
So with China, is, like you said, is a very complicated market. So there's up to what, is it 5-tier in China now? You talked about the 4 and 5 tiers. There are different marketing platforms. There used to be, I guess KOL used to be big. I think then shift to KOC. The live streaming market is still growing. And now I've seen some examples where you put up on LinkedIn where people are just using AR and VR technologies and they're putting ads up in front of the competitors. So what are some of the considerations for companies who wish to focus in China?
You need to clearly understand that China is developing with China speed. So it really depends on where is your company in China right now. Like, are we just planning to enter? Do we have a concrete plan to enter? Have we already entered and are doing kind of mediocre well? Or have we entered long time ago and we are doing phenomenally well? So which stage of China entry are you at? And then you need to do different things. If you are just figuring out whether or not China is the opportunity, do the research and focus on the things like, okay, China is developing with a certain speed. There are tons of competitors, both domestic and global. And how do we figure out what is our defendable niche and defendable position and defendable category? Most of the times, international brands, fortunately or unfortunately right now, do not have and cannot identify that defendable market position. And when you cannot identify it, you go to the next stage saying, okay, I commit to China market and I say that, yes, I want to do it. And right now I need to adjust my offering, adjust my product and make it fit and make it defendable in the market. And then you go into the next stage. Okay, once you entered China, you need to have a proper, obviously, setup. You need to make sure your legal paperwork, you know, licenses, permissions, trademarks are all clear. You need to have a clear strategy on how you're going to sell. So channel strategy, you know, TP partner, online distributor, all these things are very, very clear. Are you going to go and activate it with your internal team or external team? You know, these are important considerations to have. And of course, then doing launch event and investing money in China. By the way, if you're just entering, you know, this year, you are going to lose money for at least 18 months. So those dreams of, you know, China being the biggest market in the world, and all the Chinese are sitting there and waiting for my product to be brought into, you know, either through Tmall Global or through Tmall or through any other channel, are just not realistic. Nobody is waiting for you. There's enough offering by other international and, of course, domestic brands as well. And you need to really work very, very, very hard to get those eyeballs and get those, you know, dollars coming in. And once you establish yourself as a brand, in China, everything is branded search. So people do not look for a cup. People look for a Wedgwood cup. People don't look for the shoes. They look for Nike shoes, etc. So it's all branded search. And that is why establishing that brand, making sure that people know you, recognize you, and can search you and know how are you different is extremely, extremely important. It's much more important than what we have in the rest of the world. And yes, if you are already an established company, what you shall be really doing is, and that's what a lot of multinationals are doing right now, working with the trends. As you saw, there's so many trends. There is, of course, these were just the ones I announced are more like just consumption scenario trends, but there's a lot of trends on the technology side. For example, we have group buying, we have community retail, we have private pools, we have the way people, right, purchase and the way their journey has transformed. So what you need to do as a big company, you need to stay on top of these changes and understand which of them are just trends that are going to pass, which of these are important for us to act on, how to see the dots and connect the dots and really not miss out, because local domestic brands are moving extremely fast. Sometimes they are right, most of the times, sometimes they are wrong, but they are moving fast. They have speed, they have energy as their advantage. As a multinational company, even with very empowered local team, you're usually much, much slower. So having that in mind, you just need to be even more involved in what's happening and how do we essentially adjust our product offering, our packaging, our digital communication strategy, our sales channels, etc.
I should probably put in a caveat here, because you mentioned a lot of on external trends. There are a lot of different contents and trends predictions on the internet. I think the viewers need to be cautious that some of these trends are actually not real trends. There are a lot of vloggers and bloggers. They made up these trends because they try to get the eyeball and make money from affiliate marketing. There's a lot of copy and pasting on the internet, but I don't think a lot of people know about this.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that this is also our responsibility right now as any professionals or just part of digital kind of world, being netizens, to, you know, be careful and be selective in the information sources and kind of, you know, the news we read and the experts that we follow. And as you said, the trends that we believe in, because as you said, there's a lot of, you know, Shuijun, there's a lot of fakes in China when it comes to, you know, fake sales, fake followers, fake stuff. There's a lot of fake news. There's a lot of fake trends happening all around the world. So yes, be selective. Don't take things for face value just because you read about it online. Find the people or the person or a few sources that you trust and believe in. And then, of course, speak with professionals if you are to make a business decision, because it's not just for fun. It's a business decision and it deserves to be taken seriously.
I can't agree more with you. I want to talk about the future of China. Recently, we've seen some new policies come, not just coming out of China, coming out globally. So, for example, one of the initiatives that Tencent is doing, so they're going to implement facial recognition in China so that they can monitor minors' screen time. Personally, I, as a parent, I think that's a great thing. And if foreign companies who are planning to get listed overseas, they need to go through a local cybersecurity scan within China. And then obviously there's a lot of discussion about DD being sued by the US investors. In your view, what are some of the important internet policies that you think people should be aware of?
Well, there are many of them and they are different by sector. So in terms of internet policies, I think if we talk about, you know, general terms, China is going through right now a very important exercise, which is regulating the market. And some people like to, again, you know, sitting from outside of mainland China and probably not understanding the way it works and the market develops. And they like to judge, oh, why right now? Why in 2020 or 2021? Why is this right now such a big topic? So the way China worked, based on, again, experience and based on history, is everything is allowed before it's specifically prohibited. And in the West, when it comes to innovation, everything is prohibited unless it's specifically allowed, right? So before, for example, Bitcoin became whatever it is, people already tried to kind of come up with regulations on how to regulate it before it even takes shape. So in China, in that respect, go and do whatever you want with, for instance, Bitcoin, and maybe it's not the best example. And then when it reaches a certain state or I understand what's going on, then they go in to regulate. So it's not the best example with Bitcoin. But what I wanted to say is that right now, China's digital ecosystem has reached the stage where the government sees the need to regulate it. And ultimately, it's very good for the market, because then when the rules of the game are clear, you can safely innovate and you can safely do your job. And right now, we all agree globally that, of course, data protection and, as you said, miners' involvement in the digital, gaming space, etc., is a big issue. And somebody is trying on a global scale, but there's not much movement or consensus or rules that are really being kind of globally accepted. So what China is doing right now is they go sector by sector, they go problem by problem, and they introduce new rules. For example, with bloggers, right? China has the world's biggest blogger economy and KOL economy, where internet celebrities actually sell, they die whore, right? They sell products. And previously, I could open, as a foreigner, I could open a channel and start selling tomorrow. Right now, I actually need to be registered as a vendor. So not only as a foreigner, but also if I'm a Chinese person, if I want to sell something, I need to be registered as a vendor. I need to get a permission, kind of a little license from the government to do that. Because if I'm selling something that is fake, then they know how to find me, right? I need to run a kind of a proper business. It does make sense, but it wasn't the case, let's say, 2-3 years ago. Or bloggers being, for example, if the platform has a blogger and the blogger is, breaking law, for example, they are promoting or selling something that is illegal or fake, etc., then both the platform and the blogger will be punished. Also, it does make sense because in the West, big tech companies kind of have an easy exit, right? Saying, oh, it's not us, it's the individuals that are breaking the law, but we are so, white and fluffy and we've got nothing to do with that. Well, in China, that's not the case. And that is why, of course, the platforms are very anxious to regulate the users and KOLs and others, because they know if something goes wrong, they're going to be punished. Red, Xiaohongshu, right, Chinese social media platform, was shut down for a couple of months from new downloads, just like Didi is right now, because they had to clean up a lot of their kind of walls and announcements, because they were promoting hotels that were actually some brothels. And obviously, that was just not, not the way it's supposed to be. And the platform was punished because of the content that users were creating and essentially doing business on this platform. So all these things are taking shape. And right now, the biggest discussion points are, number one, essentially your personal information, the usage of this personal information. So you cannot use it without permission. You cannot collect information beyond the scope of the service. You cannot demand excessive permissions. For example, Kuaishou or Douyin, they were both actually notified by the National Internet Information Office for collecting, too much data that's not necessary, and also keeping them too long. Then anti-monopoly is another big investigation, another big topic that's happening right now, right? So basically, out of two, choose one kind of policy that Alibaba and, Tencent, JD, in different sectors, not only e-commerce, were running, kind of, trying to buy not just users, but trying to buy merchants most of the times and somehow pressure them into selecting just one platform. So that is becoming more and more difficult. And also, for example, recently there was this game live streaming platform Huya and Douyu, right? So their merger was stopped as well because they are trying to kind of keep the playing field less collected. Then, of course, there is, in China, it's called harassing the users, but that's not really harassment. But there's another big topic, which is bombarding the users with messages. And specifically over this 618, which is China's second largest e-commerce festival, right? The Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, they announced that if you keep harassing users with like text messages and promotions and whatever, you're going to be, you will have an issue. So like an app cannot have too many pop-up stores, and you cannot, as a brand or an app, send too many messages to the consumer and SMSs because you're trying to promote for 618. And of course, online game is, as you mentioned, is another big discussion point, you know, minors gaming, and also how much money, starting from what age can they spend maximum per app, because people get addicted, especially young people get addicted very early on, and then they have access to their parents' wallets. So this is unhealthy screen time. And also what kind of games, for example, yeah, it was a big talk about 2 years ago when blood, right, these kind of violent games where blood was abundantly shown on the screen is right now also not kind of promoted, right? You need to change the color of blood to green, and you need to basically, if your user base is very young, let's say 12, 13 years old or below, you really need to adjust some of these gaming approaches in order to potentially protect their psychological health as well. So these are just broad strokes, but again, a lot of industries, a lot of platforms, that they of course have their own regulations and their own a lot of things are in motion right now because China is going through this regulatory exercise.
Yep. Actually, I think you have just outlined a very comprehensive diagnosis of some of the key issues that are not just facing China, but globally. I believe in a digital world or non-digital world, there needs to be check and balance at a societal level. Whether you're an internet company or non-internet company, companies need to be socially responsible. You mentioned there are pros and cons, whether it's you allow first and then prohibit later, or you prohibit now and then open up later. There are pros and cons to both approaches. And personally, I'm pro with regulation as long as the regulation has been set up with good intent. So if the intents are there to protect the future of our children, to protect their well-being, and to make sure, you know, they don't develop short attention span, it helps them improve their social integration skills, why not? If, like you said, if the policy is about making sure that the sellers on these internet platforms are credible, and the products and services that they represent are doing exactly what they should be, I think there should be regulation. And if the regulation is about making sure that the contents we see on the internet are real and they're not fake and they're not spreading fear, I think these regulations we should also support. And if, like you said, if these regulations are there to protect our privacy, our personal information, not being abused by other companies, again, I think the regulation should be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much again, Ashley. We have spoken for a very long time. You have given a lot of insights, not just about doing marketing in China, but, you know, consumer behaviors and where do you think the world is going to go? Where can people find you?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest place to find me, under Ashley Dudarinok, and my DMs are open. So send me a hello message and we're going to chat.
Thank you very much for making time for this podcast. And it was my great pleasure to speak with you this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Aaron. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Transformative Purpose. In each episode, we talk to inspirational people who are making our world better. Make sure to like, rate, and review. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from the show. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, if you have questions or feedback, you can reach out at aaronpeng.co.